Well, I guess it's my pleasure to introduce myself. I mean, listen, there's so much going on here, and I'm so happy, just tickled pink with what Ace Baker and Brian Davidson and Fred Lochter have done. Absolutely sensational stuff. And what I'm going to do here is present the latest on a couple of false flags, one classic, one more recent. And in order to do that, of course, I have a lot of slides. I had originally intended to include or address Sandy Hook, but Alex Jones being returned to Twitter and giving a tweet, giving an interview with a dozen parties, including Elon Musk, caused me to revise and to consider giving an update about what we know about Sandy Hook, as well as what we know about JFK. Most of this, for most of you, is going to be pretty new stuff. We all know the official account, three shots fired from the sixth floor of the Book Depository building. What you may not know is that the day of the assassination, both the FBI and the Secret Service concluded there had been three shots with three hits. The jacket had been hit in the back, actually 5.5 inches below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column by a shallow shot that only went in about as far as a second knuckle on your little finger. That John Connally had been hit in the back, as indeed he had, a bullet that transited and exited his chest, and that JFK had been hit in the back of the head, killing him. If you put that together with what we actually would learn on radio and television that day, you get a pretty good idea. Let me just say, Oliver Stone's magisterial film, JFK, released in 1991, provides the most accurate, complete, and detailed account of what actually happened in Dealey Plaza on 22 November 1963, with three major caveats. Number one, Oliver did not know that Lee Oswald was actually standing in the doorway of the Book Depository at the time the event took place. Number two, he did not realize that the home movies of the assassination had been massively edited to conceal the true causes of death and the sequence in which the shots had been fired. And number three, he did not know that he had posited three shooting teams when it turns out there were actually eight. In my other presentations, you'll find how I explain each of the sponsors of the assassination, which include the CIA, the Joint Chiefs, the anti-Castro Cubans, the Mafia, the Texas oilmen, Israel, and the Eastern establishment surrounding the Fed, as well as Lyndon Baines Johnson. Each had their own shooter. I mean, it's fascinating. I've identified six, the locations, the shots they took, and their effects. Ole Domegaard, the seventh, with which I agree. Only the eighth, who was on the south knoll at a tree where you wouldn't believe a shooter could be located, who appears to have been a marksman for the Eastern establishment surrounding the Fed. I can identify each of the others with their source. Now, if you go back to the day of the assassination, Malcolm Kilduff said it was a simple matter of a bullet right through the head. And there he is, pointing to his forehead, attributing that finding to the head of neurology and to the present personal physician, Admiral George Berkeley. And indeed, live coverage of the assassination that day was replete with two shots being reported endlessly and in detail. One was a shot to the throat, a small, clean puncture shot throat wound that had actually passed through the windshield en route to its target, where Malcolm Perry, MD, who had performed a simple tracheostomy incision through that clean wound repeated three times during the Parkland press conference, that it had been a wound of entry, that the bullet had been coming at him. And then later in the day, you have the reports of the bullet that entered the right temple and blew out the back of his head, attributed to his personal physician, Admiral Berkeley. They were reporting this for hours on television. And then later, as the stories started to trickle in about the FBI and the Secret Service concluding there had been three shots, only fired from above and behind, Frank McGee, who was nobody's fool, said on NBC, "This is incongruous. How can the man have been shot from in front, from behind?" But if you take into account the two shots to the back and to the back of the head that were reported by the FBI and the Secret Service that day, which were true, with the two shots reported on NBC and other networks that day, the shot to the throat, the shot to the right temple, which were also true, you get the four hits to JFK, where David W. Manick, the leading expert on the medical evidence, believes there may have been a third shot near simultaneous with a shot that entered the right temple from the side. Meanwhile, decades later, it turns out most Americans do not believe the lone gunman theory. 65% believe the assassination involved a conspiracy. Remarkably, Democrats, college-educated adults, are less likely to say it was a conspiracy, no doubt because they think that's just a theory, but it's anything but. U.S. government named most often as co-conspirator, 20% up from 2013. Well, framing the patsy. Lee was in the doorway when the motorcade passed by. They made him remove his overshirt before doing mug shots because otherwise it was too easy to see the resemblance. He told Fritz, this is Will Fritz, a homicide detective in charge, when he was shown one of the backyard photographs that were used to implicate him, that his face had been pasted on someone else's body and that he knew something about photography and he'd be able to prove it eventually. Of course, he didn't live long enough. But everything Oswald told Fritz has turned out to be true. Here's the most famous and important photograph. This is taken by AP photographer James Ike Olchitz. If you look right here in the windshield, there's a small white spiral nebula with a dark hole in the center where JFK's left ear would be if it were visible. That's a bullet that hit him in the throat. Here's the area of great interest where a figure many thought to be Lee Oswald appears to be looking out to see what in the world's going on. Meanwhile, we have LBJ security already responding, even though JFK is looking around as though they have no idea what's going on. And here is a window to a broom closet in the Dow Tex building, which an anti-Castro Cuban by the name of Tony Nestor Escadro used a Mannlicher Carcano to fire three shots, where the weapon was so unreliable that one missed and hit a curbing and injured a distant bystander by the name of James Tague. Another missed and hit the chrome strip over the windshield. But after the driver brought the limousine to a halt, the third hit Jack in the back of the head. He slumped forward. Jack eased him back up and was looking right in the face when he was hit by that shot to the right temple. And then slumped, blew his brains out the back of his head, then slumped to the left. There was none of the violent back and to the left motion you see in the extant film. So here's the area we're going to investigate in greater detail. There are those such as Robert Groden and Josiah Thompson who insist this photograph has not been tampered with, but there are obvious indications they are wrong. Look at the figure. You got a guy behind known as the black tie man who's both in front of him and behind him at the same time, which is obviously impossible. You got this guy known as the black hole man because his face has been blacked out, but so has his shirt. We'll explain why. You have another face added here of a black man, apparently to obscure the features of the shirt. So here was what Lee was wearing when he was arrested. Here is the man in the photograph. We'll call him Doorman. And here is Lee with a mug shirt. Robert Hooke was absolutely brilliant in finding similarities between these two figures. He began with six or seven, wound up with over 100. And that's, of course, because they're the same guy. Rolf Sinkay, who happens to be a chiropractor who's used to dealing with people who want to get themselves in shape so their clothes will fit better, observed that. We can know the man in the doorway was Lee Oswald based on the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, and the overshirt. By the way, Marina was asked by Ed Tatro whether she remembered that shirt, and she recalled having laundered it as one Lee wore in, had brought back from Russia. But as I said, because the police were so aware of the similarity, they had him take off his overshirt. On 29 February 1964, they had Billy Lovelady, whom the government claims was a man in the doorway, come in for an interview wearing the clothing he wore at the time. He wore a short sleeve, red and white, vertically striped shirt. Billy said himself he thought it was odd they'd be confused because he was 2.5 to 3 inches shorter and 15 to 20 pounds minimally heavier than Lee Oswald. They were not remotely the same. Larry Rivera has gone further to confirm the identity by doing superpositions. If you fix the pupils of the eyes the same with a superposition, if it's taken from the same perspective, then you can get a confirmation of the identity of whether they're the same or different. In the case of Lee on the left, all the features line up. Billy Lovelady on the right, no. The jaw is wrong, the nose is wrong, the ears are wrong. It was clearly Lee and not Billy. Here's another where you can see the man in the doorway turn out to be Lee Harvey Oswald. Fascinating. The black hole man turns out to be Billy Lovelady, and that's why they obfuscated his shirt. It was, as I said, a red and white vertically striped shirt. So if we had a color version of the photograph that had been accurate, it would have looked something like this. Lee, as I said, when showed one of the backyard photographs, this one published on the cover of Life magazine to implicate the alleged assassin. Notice he's supposed to be holding the Mannlicher Carcano with which he shot JFK. He's got a revolver in a belt and a holster with which he's supposed to have shot Officer J.D. Tibbett. That's quite a story in and of itself. Oswald wasn't anywhere in the vicinity. There were four shell casings found at the Tibbett shooting, all of which had been ejected from automatics, but Oswald only had a revolver. They were of two different brands, two Remington ran to Western. The first officer on the scene initialed them. Naturally, unsurprisingly, he made a substitution in the evidence, and now you had revolver shell casings. But think about it. Would anyone with a revolver shoot a cop and then open the chamber and pull out the incriminating shell cartridges? It's an absurd story. There's a very good discussion of this in Robert Groden's book, The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, by the way. Notice, too, they had what they thought was motive because he's holding two communist newspapers, The Worker and The Militant. Interestingly, they had antithetical communist philosophies. So if they ran into each other, they'd fight each other and even try to kill each other. Jim Mars and I did a study about the backyard photographs and noticed this odd bump on the wrist of the figure in the backyard photographs correspond to this odd bump on the back of the a Dallas cop with ties to the CIA, Roscoe White, and concluded it was the same guy. Well, Larry found a suitable photograph of Roscoe in a bathing suit at a beach and superimposed. And when you look at the body build, Roscoe was significantly more physically fit and robust than Lee. You superimpose Roscoe fits the man in the backyard photographs. Lee, however, does not. In fact, here you see, Lee was so much more slight of build that he cannot possibly have been the man in the backyard photographs, just as he explained to Fritz. Meanwhile, concealing the truth, editing the Z film, they crudely blacked out the blowout at the back of the head in early frames, cut out too many, producing the striking back into the left phenomenon. They merged two shots, the merge to the back of the head and the shot to the right temple. So you don't have Jack slumping forward, back, Jackie easing him up. But I discovered you can actually see the blowout in later frames, such as 374. So here's a Zapruder film, the massively edited version we have today. Notice they took out the limo stop. All of a sudden, boom, there's a limousine there. You don't see it turning the corner. Then as you proceed, there's so much going on here. All of a sudden, you're going to see, blam, his brain splattered. It turns out that this was all done artificially. They actually took that frame 313 and altered it, painting in the blood spray and the like. John P. Costello, who's a leading expert on the Zapruder film, has done a brilliant tutorial about it. You can find it many places, including at assassinationresearch.com, which John Costello and I co-edited for many years. It's a superb collection of research. Here's 312, the frame before. Here's frame 313. If I went back and forth, you can see there's forward motion there. So that Josiah Thompson in his book, 6 Seconds in Talus, provided a very scientific study of the forward motion from 312 to 313, which, well, we have the remains of the shot from behind. Here you can see the steady motion and then the forward and then back and to the left, back and to the left. So dramatic. Not only did Josiah Thompson publish that study, but David Lifton, who authored what I regard as the single most important book ever published on the assassination, Best Evidence, took photographs like these to Caltech and showed them to Richard Feynman, who actually took a ruler and established that this double hit had taken place. Here's 314. Now, I want to mention, they blacked out the back of the head so you can't see the blowout, but there's ever blackout areas that turn out to be important, though it's only of now, recently, we've discovered why these other blackout areas are so important. They seem to have taken the blowout at the back of the head and moved it forward as though it had been a blowout at the front of the head, as you might expect from a shot far behind. But Jackie, in her testimony, the Warren Commission, which they did not publish on the specious grounds that it would have violated her primacy, said, you know, from the front, he looked just fine. But she had a terrible time holding his skull and brains together at the back of his head. Even Zapruder appears to have been in on it because he went on to television and said he saw this blowout at the front of the head. But that's an artifact. That was added to the film when they edited it. Again, I say these other areas we haven't paid attention to in the past turn out to be very, very important. Well, here it occurred to me they spent so much time on early frames, they might have overlooked that you could actually see the blowout in later frames. This is Jackie who's climbing out on the trunk after a chunk of Jack's skull and brains that was lying there. She held it in her hand all the way to Parkland. After they pried Jack's moribund body out of her hand, she composed herself. She walked into trauma room number one, turned to Pepper Jenkins, the anesthesiology, extended her hand and asked, will this help? If you do the close-up, you can see the blowout. Remember, brains are often called gray matter. It's bluish gray. This pink thing is a skull flap that was blown open, I believe, by that third shot to the head David Manick addressed. It's still attached to the skull, but that's not part of the blowout. Now, Manick did studies of the lateral cranial x-ray to the right side of JFK's head. He thought going in to the National Archives, this is in late 1992, that he'd discover evidence that all x-rays had been altered. He thought the contrast here was far too great to be bona fide. And he identified this area P as having been produced by a material that was far too dense to be human bone. So unless JFK was a bonehead, unless his back of his head was all solid bone, this was not a naturally occurring phenomenon, but a patch. And indeed, if you compare the patch with what we can see in frame 374, while the hair overlaps, you can see the correspondence there. I have no doubt about it. Here we have the blowout to the back of the head. Meanwhile, the motorcycle escort officers, an interview was done with them by Fred Newcomb that lay dormant. He did it in like 1971. But it lay dormant until Larry Rivera rediscovered and transcribed, which is a very tedious process. It turns out all four of the motorcycle officers and their escort confirmed the following scenario. And let me add, it's also confirmed by at least six individuals of my acquaintance who have seen what they call the other film that appears to be an unedited or at least dramatically less edited version of what we have available today. During the limo stop, he was hit at least twice in the head and possibly thrice. This was all during the limo stop. Officer Baker, who was riding to the left rear and who was hit with debris so hard that he thought he himself had been shot, dismounted his bike and ran between the two limousines up to the grassy knoll from which he believed those shots had been fired. Obviously, that would have been impossible had the vehicles been in motion. Officer Jackson on the right rode his bike up the grassy knoll until it fell over, and then he proceeded on foot. Five Secret Service agents surrounded the presidential limousine, and believe it or not, one climbed into the car. Now, this is over and beyond Clint Hill. You've already seen Clint Hill rush up there to the back and reported that he pushed Jackie down and lay across her bodies and then witnessed this gaping, bloody fist-sized hole in the back of JFK's head. He was the first to observe it up close and personal. So here you have something about the time the limousine stop took place. But remember, they've edited the film to mark it out. What you have taking place is just as I described. Hargis parking his bike and then walking, running between them up to the grassy knoll. Jackson motoring his bike until it falls over five, surrounding the latest development, discovering one of them actually climbed in. Here you can see the marks in the grass from Officer Jackson having motored up the grassy knoll. Most of you probably had no idea any of this had taken place. It even wound up in one report from the Oklahoma City Times. A first tip-off of tragedy when several spectators jumped over a stone wall and started running toward what apparently was a scene of the shooting. A motorcycle patrolman pulled pell-mell up a railroad embankment, apparently in pursuit of the assassin. Meanwhile, you have Hargis then returning the limousine, of course, after this stop took off pell-mell for Parkland Hospital. What we have now, and you can find it in the new JFK show, this is just from last week, December 13th. Exceptional producing proof that the Zapruder film had to be edited to take out the limo stop, during which he was hit at least twice in the head, and a second Secret Service agent, Glenn Bennett, climbed into the limousine. This is astonishing. You can be seen to begin to see here where modern technology has made enabled us to go further. Here are some of the striking features. I gotta tell you, Larry Rivera has been doing this most brilliant work. You want to go to my Twitter or to my BitChute channel, Jim Fetzer, you'll find them both. Meanwhile, Alex Jones did this interview. There were 12 of them present, including Elon Musk. He claimed to clear the air about Sandy Hook, following in line by saying it was a real school shooting. Very troubling. He talks about professors, me, and school safety expert Wolfgang Halbig having misled him, if he had only read the book. Don't take my word for it. Listen to Alex being questioned by this fellow about how horrible it would be to criticize a parent who had lost children at a shooting, taking for granted it was authentic.
I don't know how much. Would you like the short answer or the medium answer?
I think at least the medium answer. I guess people just want to know, like, obviously it would be like heartless and cruel to deny a school shooting of children, or to attack the parents or anyone who was involved. It seems that would be, you know, just incredibly mean and cruel, frankly. So it's sort of that's I think, you know, what a lot of people are upset about, or at least they think that is the reason to be upset about. Sure. And you know, if that were true, I think we would rightly be, you know, upset with you.
Yeah, yes, sir. Well, please let me then just tell you what really happened, okay? And if you want me to send you a dossier with clips and videos and articles,
I mean, post it to your account, you know.
Yes, sir, I will do that. So let me tell you what happened. I'm a guy that didn't go to college. I mean, a few years of community college. I started out on Access TV 29 years ago. I was not professionally trained, and by 2016, I had 30 million viewers and listeners a day. Conservatively, I was the biggest show, as big as Rogan is now, or bigger. And I had a very small operation and did not even understand how powerful I was. And so when that event, I just call it the school shooting, which I do believe happened 11 years ago, the internet exploded, and it was the top story for off and on for years, with all these professors and former school safety people and all of them saying they believed it was a drill. And I simply covered them covering that. What was entered in court against me in both cases, where I was found guilty by judges, kind of like in New York, there's a judge in Trump's case, not even a jury, in his real estate case. And then years later, after Trump got elected and after I was deplatformed, it made me bigger. And so suddenly I would wake up and there would be sometimes 100 articles or more a day, every major news channel saying that I was currently saying nobody died, currently sending people to their houses, currently peeing on graves. I didn't even know these people's names. I only said one of their names ever. Now I believe their children died, and I understand
okay.
all that.
Okay.
But I'm saying, imagine I was not deplatformed, no mention of the school shooting in Connecticut for like 6-7 years. Then they go back to my timeline, and it turns out it was a big New York PR firm, Democratic Party. They dredge it up. They run hundreds of articles, sometimes a day, but a week for over a year. Suddenly it becomes a big story again.
What's the PR firm? People,
I don't know.
Let me just say, Alex Jones, during a video deposition in Connecticut, claimed he never read the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. What sense does that make to have never read the only objective study with 13 experts, who, including 6 PhDs, who concluded the school was closed and there were no students there? I mean, check it out. You can read a review of it. Brian Wright did a brilliant review of it. Let me share a couple parts. Review of an important book that Amazon refused to publish. Yes. The book went on sale on 22 October 2015, and it sold nearly 500 copies when it was banned on 19 November. And I released it, recognizing this was a political event. There's no point in arguing with Amazon about it. They're supposed to be in the business of publishing books and making money. They were going to make a lot of money on this book. With nearly 500 in less than a month, it was going to be a runaway bestseller. But that was the problem. I have no doubt that it was under the influence of the government that wanted this book suppressed, that Amazon banned it on 19 November. Recognizing this was political and about to go on a rent show with Jeff, I made the decision to release it for free as a PDF. They did not see that coming. Here is Brian Wright's review. This story first came my way by Mike Adams and his report that Amazon was getting into the book banning business with this particular title, which to me proved that whatever the book's point, it was worth living into. The authors made it easy by publishing the book in PDF format and making it freely available here and many other locations. Editor's note, mine, which a Posner versus Fetzer lawsuit was designed to staunch, and which under court order I am not presently able to provide. So, Brian Wright continues, I have read the book and digested its essentials. As a professional editor, I find nobody's copy editing and formatting less than stellar, but the book is well organized and the content bona fide. It touches all the bases and answers the hard questions. To an epistemological certainty, Sandy Hook was not real. Nobody real died. Sandy Hook was a FEMA drill with a purpose of generating support for an extreme gun control and federal power agenda. This review will simply catalog the main factual data that demonstrates that certainty. 489 students minus 20 meant there were 469 plus 70 staff and teachers there, nowhere to be found, no evacuation, no string of buses to take them away. The driveway was so cluttered you couldn't have got a bus in there if you wanted. The benefits to those who participated in the Sandy Hook hoax have been substantial. The donation sites created by families of the victims have hauled in over $270 million in excess of $1 million per family. Was Sandy Hook Elementary School even operational on December 14, 2012, or had it been abandoned? In an interview with Wick and Helbig on Truth Radio show on March 21, 2014, InfoWars reporter Dan Bondini said at the 5:45 mark, the school's been closed down for God knows how long. Neighbors can't understand why there were kids in that building because it was condemned. Reports of Sandy Hook Elementary being contaminated with asbestos, requiring expensive repairs, photographic evidence of an abandoned school, absence of handicapped parking spaces and signage, absence of internet activity, 2008 to 2012, Wolfgang Helbig's Freedom of Information hearing. Meanwhile, among our most important discoveries has been the FEMA manual for the Sandy Hook event, which I published as Appendix A, which specifies that a rehearsal will be conducted on December 13, 2012, with the event going live on the 14th. These photographs, day after the shooting, provide further substantiation of my inference that the school had been closed by 2008, which I published with Amanda in Sandy Hook Elementary School closed in 2008, a stage in 2012. The building is covered with moss and grime with many indications of repairs left undone. Exhibit 1, absence of compliance with Americans with Disability Act. Exhibit 2, presence of electrical hazard for teachers, staff, and students alike. Exhibit 3, absence of wheelchair accessibility and improper maintenance. Exhibit 4, presence of stored items of every shape, kind, and description. That's what they do with abandoned schools. They leave them, use them for storage. So I offer you proof here and now, as I have done before elsewhere, that of three of the key featured figures in the Sandy Hook saga being alive and well, Emily Parker, the darling little blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl, Noah Posner, the darling little boy, the youngest in the class, Victoria Soto, the teacher, who heroically sacrificed her life to save her kids in her classroom. Here's a piece of and supposed to be Lenny Posner, Leonard Posner, same party who had sued me in Madison County Circuit Court for alleged defamation by declaring that a death certificate he'd shared with my research colleague Kelly Watt was a fabrication. It was incomplete. It had no file number, no town or state certification. Here's his photograph with little Noah. Well, Kelly Watt noticed that little Noah bore a striking resemblance to Michael Vabner, who was supposed to be his older half-brother. So six of us went to work on it. We found they had the same eyes, the same nose, the same mouth, the same ears. Here, Larry Rivera created a GIF, where you can see little Noah turn into Michael Vabner, who is alive and well, actually doing stand-up comedy in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So here's a fourfold parts of the GIF. Meanwhile, to my surprise, I received a phone call from a fellow by the name of Stu Vlecha, reaching out to me and initiating the most fascinating adventure of my life. We spoke almost daily for 6 months from the 26th of December of 2021. In other words, well through the middle of last year. Emily found this, her actual name is Margaret Alice Cottle. She's quite brilliant. She was very adept at research. The three of them were all very upset by the abuse to which I'd been subjected in the courts right here in Wisconsin, with a $450,000 finding for an alleged defamation, and then an additional $650,000 for contempt of court when I tried to prove that the party who came here and testified under the name of Leonard Posner was not Leonard Posner. Emily even found Noah celebrating his 8th birthday on a Lenny page. This is on his own website. I can't use it here, because Lenny would claim copyright and force me to take it down. But she found it. I have it. She also found the exercise on Connecticut FEMA's own scheduling agenda. I have that for you. They even included a map from Bridgeport to Sandy Hook School. This is Steve. Called me at 5:53 on Sunday, the 26th of December. Then again on the 27th of February. The last call we had then was on the 3rd of June, but we have spoken since. Now, this turns out to be a Photoshop. This is supposed to be the family of Emily with her two sisters. This actually is her uncle, and they aren't her sisters. They are her cousins. Emily, actually, Margaret, was there that day. This is Margaret here in a pink shirt on the driveway the day of the event. This is in Utah. There's a family Gray Parker. This is one and one for Cottle, the family name. This is her with her two cousins, supposed to be her sisters. Here she is today. She is super smart. I am so impressed with Margaret. Well, then, what about Victoria Lee Soto, who is an American teacher killed at the San Diego Elementary shooting gunman? Her actual name is Victoria Aurelio. She is a daughter of the Sandy Hook town clerk, Debbie Aurelio. They liked her so much, they recast her as Eva Morales at Uvalde. Here's S.J. Rollins. You mentioned Victoria Soto, that's her on the right, resurrected as Eva Morales in time to be shot at Uvalde. Jim, did you know that our favorite Muslim, Dr. Oz, had a kid on his TV show who supposedly survived Sandy Hook? A Turkish doctor asked this kid a few leading softball questions like, are you proud of your teacher? The kid shrugs his shoulders and says, yes. After this continues, he gets frustrated and annoys and says, it was a drill. What? And Dr. Oz does nothing with his bombshell this kid dropped? Can anyone see the ridiculousness? So there you have the Sandy Hook teacher on the right and in Texas on the left. I actually was talking to Steve on the phone and Margaret was there calling Vicky and asked her, just learning that she was replaying her role in Texas, how much she was being paid. And I heard Margaret repeat $210,000 to reprise her role. It's fascinating. But Wayne Carver, who is a medical examiner at Sandy Hook, who said they didn't allow the parents to come into contact with the children, who was supposed to be among the dear departed, turned up alive and well in the background of this shot. Check it out. I have no doubt.
The healing will take place. It's just going to take a while.
Watch it again. But healing will take place.
But the healing will take place. It's just going to take a while.
That's how they do it. They recycle. She discovered that the Connecticut FEMA had the drill right on its schedule. I got the link. I got it put together. It was included in my submissions to the Supreme Court of the United States. They had this evidence in my file. Notice, you scroll down the page, and you got FEMA L-366, Planning for the Needs of Children in Disasters, 12-14-2014, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. That was a Sandy Hook Elementary School event, 18 miles away. And they were very convenient. They included a map to get from Bridgeport down to Dickinson Drive, where the elementary school was located. Meanwhile, what I also learned is it wasn't even an elementary school. Notice you have the sign, Sandy Hook School. People don't stop and think about that. It doesn't say Sandy Hook Elementary School, and that's because it was not an elementary school. It was a special needs school. And that's why you have an unusual access and entrance arrangement here. For a real elementary school, you need a neat U-shaped driveway so you can drive in one side, pick up the kids, and drive out. In this case, you would have had a potential for massive traffic jams. As I already mentioned in other photographs, you can see that the driveway here was so clogged, you could not have got a bus or an ambulance in if your life depended upon it. And in this case, it did not. Let me just mention a couple of features from this photograph. Even though it was a 38-degree Fahrenheit day, which is above freezing, it was too cold to conduct classes unless you had heated the building. But there was no heat or steam rising from the building. No doubt from the fact that the boilers, after disuse, were dysfunctional. Also, I mentioned no handicap parking. There should have been handicap parking in the familiar blue and white signage here. It's not there. I checked the federal and state law for Connecticut for 2012, and the law would have required that handicap signage. It would have required wheelchair accessibility for all the entrances and exits, but it wasn't there, meaning it could not have been legally operating as a public school on 14 December 2012. Notice too, all the vehicles in these two center rows are parked facing the school. Well, look at the directions. The driving directions have you come in, you drive around, you curl, and you'd park facing away. So what happened here? Well, it appears it was just much simpler to bring all the vehicles in a single row and put them in vehicle by vehicle, all parked facing the school. It was just easier. Who was even going to notice? After all, they were just props. And it turns out the Connecticut State Police were running the drill behind the scene. So who is even going to notice? Margaret also pointed out, and this was very astute, this school has no playground. This school, I repeat, has no playground. Now, how many have ever heard of an elementary school that doesn't have a playground? And that's because it was not an elementary school. It was a special needs school. And guess what? It did close by 2008, but it actually closed in 2006. So in 2006, then Attorney General Eric Holder travels to Newtown. He meets with the community. He offers them, and this is all information I'm getting from Steve and Margaret and Vicky, of which I was heretofore unaware, and which I kept in confidence until they reported to me that they'd done a public broadcast, at which point I believed I was free to share this information with the public. Eric Holder came to Newtown in 2006 and offered the community $140 million if they would participate in this elaborate charade. Now, the idea was supposed to be to illustrate to the American people what could happen, what might happen if we didn't take guns away from the American people. You could have even some kid, and the whole story about Adam Lanza was ridiculous beyond belief. 120-pound string bean is supposed to have been carting around nearly 100 pounds in ammo and weapons, shooting his way into the building, killing all these teachers and students. It was absolutely astonishing because it was so implausible. But what he did was offer the money to the community. The residents of Newtown who did not want to be involved moved out. They moved out of Sandy Hook. They actually had auditions for roles. They had auditions for roles. They had non-disclosure agreements. Everyone had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. They had fringe benefits. How's this for a fringe benefit? You participate in this drill and you no longer have to pay taxes. You participate in this drill, you no longer have to, you can go to college for free. Your tuition will be covered. They got all this information. So while we were accurate in believing the school had been closed by 2006, it actually 2008, it had actually been closed in 2006. And believe it or not, it wasn't even an elementary school. And I've got to say, they have continued this whole process unabated. They've had one false flag, phony stage event after another, including, of course, the Boston Marathon bombing. That was really outrageous because you had the Boston Globe, a preeminent newspaper of the United States, publishing, tweeting that a bomb would be set off, a demonstration bomb would be set off for the benefit of the bomb squad activities during the marathon. Another tweet that a bomb will be set off in 1 minute in front of the library. And lo and behold, a minute later, one of the bombs is set off in front of the library. Now, as a former Marine Corps artillery officer, I can assure you, these were puff bombs. They weren't powerful enough to kill anybody unless perhaps you were actually sitting right on top of them. For example, an explosion went off in the vicinity of an outdoor cafe that was surrounded by banners, which were made out of plastic and cloth. The banners weren't even tattered or torn, meaning the shrapnel was so insignificant it didn't even damage the banners, much less kill anyone. And yet, as the cameras moved in through the smoke, you could see bodies lying there that were missing arms and legs. Well, it's Dr. Lorraine Day, who is now, alas, departed this earth, who was a great truth speaker, has explained many times, having supervised an emergency medical hospital in San Francisco for 25 years, you cannot have limbs blown off by explosives and there be no blood. The fact is, the blood only showed up later, and it came out of what I initially thought were tubes, but it was actually orange duffel kits. Who would have believed you'd have amputee actors with fake blood, but it only shows up later? I've reported this again and again. Take another incident, Orlando. This again was a Pulse nightclub in Orlando. It turns out the permit for the Pulse Club had expired 3 years before. It turns out that's when they repainted the club from white to black. It only had a legal occupancy of 150. And yet, according to the reports, they were given over 300 were packed into the nightclub. That would have made them like sardines in a can. And yet they created phony footage showing them dancing, largely spaced out, which would have been impossible had there been 300. One of the key tells here, by the way, is that at all three, at Sandy Hook, Boston bombing, Orlando, you didn't have a turnout of emergency medical technicians, EMTs. You didn't have call for a medevac helicopter. You didn't have ambulances showing up. I mean, in Orlando, you had civilians who were throwing bodies into trucks to take them to emergency care. Well, that's ridiculous. If you mess with an injured body, you may aggravate their injuries and bring about their death. It's not something that would be done. The whole thing was a total fraud. Parkland down in Florida. Turns out they had 3,500 students there, but because it was Valentine's Day, they sent the kids home early at 1 p.m. Only a few dozen stayed behind to be student crisis actors, the most prominent among them being David Hogg, who turns out to be the son of an FBI agent who specializes in areas like this and who appears to have actually previously graduated from Laguna Hills High School but came to Parkland because he has a useful look and because he could be a spokesman. You give him, he's given this report about, you know, filming the shooting behind the scene. I mean, look, there were a lot of the cops there who thought it was real. But Sheriff David Israel, who drives a Lamborghini, when have you heard of a sheriff driving a Lamborghini, apparently held them back, for which he would later be criticized, worried they might shoot the actual perp. What they did at Parkland was use a guy dressed up in a SWAT suit, including a helmet, using what's known as a sim gun that fired simulated ammunition made out of beeswax and laundry detergent. Simulated ammunition will not penetrate the skin. It will create welts. That's what it does. It's designed for this purpose, which is why you had individuals like Matty and Samantha, who claim, you know, they recovered from the AR-15 wounds, and you got a fake doctor who says she was shot in the abdomen and the chest with an AR-15, and yet she's recovered because young people recover very fast. What nonsense. If you're shot with an AR-15, man, in the chest or the abdomen, you're dead. You're not walking around days later with Band-Aids on your wounds. So I tell you again, if you want to get deeper into these false flags, which were all unleashed by Obama by nullifying the Smith-Mundt Act. You want to go to my blog, check out for this conference, and you'll find I've made available the law enforcement false flag stage event checklist I co-authored with Brian Davidson. And it gives you a link to a whole lot, including, for example, Las Vegas. That was another monster scam where Mona Alexis Presley did brilliant work on the alleged decedents when discovering that when their photographed image weren't merely Photoshop variations, so you got the same person appearing twice. They're all based on persons who died in different states or on different dates or from different causes of death. At Mandalay Bay, what they did was play a pre-recorded soundtrack of machine gun firing over the PA system, complemented by special video effects in the middle of the hotel, flashing lights to simulate machine gun firing, higher up, three light bursts, which were interspersed because American military weapons fire in three shots burst. We even have a video of a guy in the crowd turning and firing, and you can see the flash of his muzzle, but no one's dying or falling because it was all done with blanks. You got the photograph of the one party who may have died at Las Vegas, the alleged shooter, Stephen Paddock, in his suite, and you can see his head lying on a pool of blood and their shell casings on the blood. Scott Bennett, my dear friend, former Army Intel and PSYOP officer with his keen eye, observed that they included gas cartridges, cartridges for gas-propelled pellet guns and for blanks. In other words, the prop master didn't know enough about what she was doing. She just threw down a handful of shell casings to simulate shots having been fired. But think about it. If once he's dead, he stops shooting. So if there were any shell casings there, they had to be underneath the blood, not on top. This is why you've got to be informed. The government is perpetrating these frauds again and again and again, which is, of course, among the most important reasons why I organize conferences like this now for the fourth year in a row to help you better understand what's going on and avoid being played. We're going to take a brief break and bring together all four of the speakers of this morning for a question session. Use the Q&A at the bottom of your screen if you're here in the Zoom room. Now, those who are at Brighteon watching, that's, you don't have that benefit. You had to be in the Zoom room here to be able to submit questions for the speakers to address. But please do that. While we take a brief break, you can make a pit stop, whatever, grab a bite, whatever. We'll be back in about 5 minutes to continue our conference today.